and with having conceived of the idea of the debt for nature swap. Over the years, he has worked for the World Wildlife Fund, the Smithsonian, the United Nations Foundation, and the World Bank, and in good part owing to his efforts, something like half the Amazon rainforest is now under some form of legal protection. Lovejoy is the rare sort of person who seems equally comfortable slogging through the forest and testifying in front of Congress. He is always looking for ways to drum up support for Amazon conservation, and while we were sitting around that evening, he told me he'd once brought Tom Cruise to Camp 41. Cruise, he said, had seemed to enjoy himself, but, unfortunately, had never taken up the cause. By now, more than 500 scientific papers and several scientific books have been written about the BDFFP. When I asked Lovejoy to sum up what had been learned from the project, he said that one had to be cautious extrapolating from a part to the whole. For example, recent work has shown that changes in land use in the Amazon also affect atmospheric circulation. This means that, on a large enough scale, destruction of the rainforest could result not just in a disappearance of the forest, but in a disappearance of the rain. Suppose you ended up with a landscape cut up into 100-hectare fragments, Lovejoy said. I think what the project has shown is that you basically would have lost more than half the fauna and flora. Of course, you know, in the real world, it's always more complicated. Most of the findings from the BDFFP have indeed been variations on the theme of loss. 6 species of primates can be found in the area of the project. 3 of these, the black spider monkey, the brown capuchin monkey, and the bearded saki, are missing from the fragments. Birds like the long-tailed woodcreeper and the olive-backed foliage gleaner, which travel in mixed species flocks, have all but disappeared from the smaller fragments and are found at much lower abundance in the larger ones. Frogs that breed in peccary wallows have vanished, along with the peccaries that produce the wallows. Many species, sensitive even to slight changes in light and heat, have declined in abundance toward the edges of the fragments, though the number of light-loving butterflies has increased. Meanwhile, though this is somewhat beyond the scope of the BDFFP, there's a dark synergy between fragmentation and global warming, just as there is between global warming and ocean acidification, and between global warming and invasive species, and between invasive species and fragmentation. A species that needs to migrate to keep up with rising temperatures, but is trapped in a forest fragment, even a very large fragment, is a species that isn't likely to make it. One of the defining features of the Anthropocene is that the world is changing in ways that compel species to move, and another is that it's changing in ways that create barriers, roads, clear cuts, cities, that prevent them from doing so. The whole new layer on top of what I was thinking about in the 1970s is climate change, Lovejoy told me. He has written that, in the face of climatic change, even natural climatic change, human activity has created an obstacle course for the dispersal of biodiversity, the result of which could be one of the greatest biotic crises of all time. That night, everyone went to sleep early. After what felt like a few minutes, but might have been a few hours, I was woken by the most extraordinary racket. The sound seemed to be coming from nowhere and everywhere. It would rise to a crescendo, fall off, and then, just as I was starting to fall back to sleep, start up again. I knew it was the mating call of some kind of frog, and I got out of my hammock and grabbed a flashlight to take a look around. I couldn't find the source of the noise, but I did come across an insect with a bioluminescent stripe, which I would have liked to put in a jar, had there been any jars to put it in. The next morning, Cone Haft pointed out a pair of manaus slender-legged tree frogs, locked in amplexus. The frogs were an orangey brown, with shovel-shaped faces. The male, clamped on the female's back, was about half her size. I recalled having read that amphibians in the Amazon lowlands, so far at least, seemed largely to have escaped Kittred. Cone Haft, who along with everyone else had been kept up by the din, described the frog's call as a prolonged groaning that explodes into a roar and ends in a chuckling laugh. After several cups of coffee, we set out to watch the ant parade. Lovejoy had planned to come with us, but when he went to go put on a long-sleeve shirt, a spider that had taken up residence in it bit him on the hand. The spider looked relatively ordinary, but the bite was turning an angry red, and Lovejoy's hand was going numb. It was decided that he should stay at the camp. "The ideal method is to let the ants come in around you," Cone Haft explained as we hiked along. "Then there's no way out. It's like painting yourself into a corner. And the ants will come up on you, and they'll bite your clothes, and you're in the middle of the action." In the distance, he heard a rufous-throated ant bird making a sound somewhere between a tweet and a cackle. As the name suggests, rufous-throated ant birds are obligate ant followers. So Cone Haft took this as a promising sign. However, a few minutes later, when we reached the spot where we'd seen their endless column the day before, the ants were nowhere to be found. Cone Haft heard two other ant birds calling from the trees, a white-plumed ant bird, which makes a high-pitched whistling noise, and a white-chinned woodcreeper, which has an upbeat, twittery song. They, too, seem to be looking for the ants. "They're as confused as we are," Cone Haft said. He speculated that the ants had been moving their bivouac and had now gone into what is known as their statuary phase. During this phase, the ants stay more or less in one place to raise a new generation. The statuary phase can last for up to 3 weeks, which helps explain one of the more puzzling discoveries to come out of the BDFFP. Even forest fragments large enough to support colonies of army ants end up losing their ant birds. Obligate ant followers need foraging ants to follow, and apparently, in the fragments, there just aren't enough colonies to ensure that one will always be active. Here again, Cone Half told me, was a demonstration of the rainforest's logic. The ant birds are so good at doing exactly what they do that they're extremely sensitive to any change that makes their particular form of doing more difficult. When you find one thing that depends on something else, that in turn depends on something else, the whole series of interactions depends on constancy, he said. I thought about this as we trudged back to camp. If Cone Haft was right, then in its crazy circus-like complexity, the ant-bird-butterfly parade was actually a figure for the Amazon's stability. Only in a place where the rules of the game remain fixed is there time for butterflies to evolve, to feed on the shit of birds that evolved to follow ants. Yes, I was disappointed that we hadn't found the ants, but I figured I had nothing on the birds. Chapter 10 The New Pangaea, Myotis lucificus. The best time to take a bat census is the dead of winter. Bats are what is known as true hibernators. When the mercury drops, they begin looking for a place to settle down, or really upside down, since bats in torpor hang by their toes. In the northeastern United States, the first bats to go into hibernation are usually the little browns. Sometime in late October or early November, they seek out a sheltered space, like a cave or a mine shaft, where conditions are likely to remain stable. The little browns are soon joined by the tricolored bats, and then by the big browns and the small-footed bats. The body temperature of a hibernating bat drops by 50 or 60 degrees, often to right around freezing. Its heartbeat slows, its immune system shuts down, and the bat, dangling by its feet, falls into a state close to suspended animation. Counting hibernating bats demands a strong neck, a good headlamp, and a warm pair of socks. In March 2007, some wildlife biologists from Albany, New York, went to conduct a bat census at a cave just west of the city. This was a routine event, so routine that their supervisor, Al Hicks, stayed behind at the office. As soon as the biologists arrived at the cave, they pulled out their cell phones. They said, "Holy shit, there's dead bats everywhere." Hicks, who works for the New York State's Department of Environmental Conservation, would later recall. Hicks instructed them to bring some carcasses back to the office. He also asked the biologists to photograph any live bats they could find. When Hicks examined the photos, he saw that the animals looked as if they had been dunked, nose first, in talcum powder. This was something he had never encountered before, and he began emailing the photographs to all the bat specialists he could think of. None of them had ever seen anything like it either. Some of Hicks's counterparts in other states took a joking tone. What they wanted to know, they said, was what those bats in New York were snorting. Spring arrived. Bats all across New York and New England awoke from their torpor and flew off. The white powder remained a mystery. We were thinking, "Oh boy, we hope this just goes away," Hicks told me. It was like the Bush administration. And, like the Bush administration, it just wouldn't go away. Instead, it spread. The following winter, the same white powdery substance was found on bats in 33 caves in 4 different states. Meanwhile, bats kept dying. In some hibernacula, populations plunged by more than 90%. In one cave in Vermont, thousands of corpses dropped from the ceiling and piled up on the ground, like snowdrifts. The bat die-off continued the following winter, spreading to 5 more states. It continued the winter after that, in 3 additional states, and although in many places there are hardly any bats left to kill off, it continues to this day. The white powder is now known to be a cold-loving fungus, what's known as a psychrophile, that was accidentally imported to the U.S., probably from Europe. When it was first isolated, the fungus, from the genus Geomyces, had no name. For its effect on the bats, it was dubbed Geomyces destructans. Without human help, long-distance travel is for most species difficult, bordering on impossible. This fact was to Darwin central. His theory of descent with modification demanded that each species arise at a single place of origin. To spread from there, it either slithered or swam or loped or crawled or cast its seeds upon the wind. Given a long enough time, even a sedentary organism, like say a fungus, could, Darwin thought, become widely dispersed. But it was the limits of dispersal that made things interesting. These accounted for life's richness and at the same time for the patterns that could be discerned amid the variety. The barriers imposed by the oceans, for instance, explained why vast tracts of South America, Africa, and Australia, though in Darwin's words entirely similar in climate and topography, were populated by entirely dissimilar flora and fauna. The creatures on each continent had evolved separately, and in this way, physical isolation had been transmuted into biological disparity. Similarly, the barriers imposed by land explained why the fish of the eastern Pacific were distinct from the fish of the western Caribbean, though these two groups were, as Darwin wrote, separated only by the narrow but impassable Isthmus of Panama. On a more local level, the species found on one side of a mountain range or a major river were often different from the species found on the other, though usually and significantly, they were related. Thus, for example, Darwin noted, "The plains near the Straits of Magellan are inhabited by one species of rhea, and northward the plains of La Plata by another species of the same genus, and not by a true ostrich or emu, like those found in Africa and Australia." The limits of dispersal concerned Darwin in another way too, this one harder to account for. As he'd seen firsthand, even remote volcanic islands, like the Galapagos, were full of life. Indeed, islands were home to many of the world's most marvelous creatures. For his theory of evolution to be correct, these creatures must be the descendants of colonizers. But how had the original colonizers arrived? In the case of the Galapagos, 500 miles of open water separated the archipelago from the coast of South America. So vexed was Darwin by this problem that he spent over a year trying to replicate the conditions of an ocean crossing in the garden of his home in Kent. He collected seeds and immersed them in tanks of salt water. Every few days he dredged out some of the seeds and planted them. The exercise proved time-consuming, for, he wrote to a friend, "the water I find must be renewed every other day, as it gets to smell horribly." But the results, he thought, were promising. Barley seeds still germinated after 4 weeks' immersion, cress seeds after 6, though the seeds gave out a surprising quantity of slime. If an ocean current flowed at the rate of roughly 1 mile per hour, then over the course of 6 weeks, a seed could be carried more than 1,000 miles. How about an animal? Here Darwin's methods became even more baroque. He sliced off a pair of duck's feet and suspended them in a tank filled with snail hatchlings. After allowing the duck's feet to soak for a while, he lifted them out and had his children count how many hatchlings were attached. The tiny mollusks, Darwin found, could survive out of water for up to 20 hours. And in this length of time, he calculated, a duck with its feet attached might cover 600 or 700 miles. It was no mere coincidence, he observed, that many remote islands have no native mammals save for bats, which can fly. Darwin's ideas about what he termed geographical distribution had profound implications, some of which would not be recognized until decades after his death. In the late 19th century, paleontologists began to catalog the many curious correspondences exhibited by fossils gathered on different continents. Mesosaurus, for example, is a skinny reptile with splayed-out teeth that lived during the Permian period. Mesosaurus remains turn up both in Africa and an ocean away in South America. Glossopteris is a tongue-shaped fern, also from the Permian period. Its fossils can be found in Africa, in South America, and in Australia. Since it was hard to see how a large reptile could have crossed the Atlantic, or a plant, both the Atlantic and the Pacific, vast land bridges extending for several thousand miles were invoked. Why these ocean-spanning bridges had vanished, and where they had gone to, no one knew. Presumably, they had sunk beneath the waves. In the early years of the 20th century, the German meteorologist Alfred Wegener came up with a better idea. "The continents must have shifted," he wrote. "South America must have lain alongside Africa and formed a unified block. The two parts must then have become increasingly separated over a period of millions of years, like pieces of a cracked ice floe in water." At one time, Wegener hypothesized, all of the present-day continents had formed one giant supercontinent, Pangaea. Wegener's theory of continental drift, widely derided during his lifetime, was, of course, to a large extent vindicated by the discovery of plate tectonics. One of the striking characteristics of the Anthropocene is the hash it's made of the principles of geographic distribution. If highways, clear cuts, and soybean plantations create islands where none before existed, global trade and global travel do the reverse. They deny even the remotest islands their remoteness. The process of remixing the world's flora and fauna, which began slowly, along the routes of early human migration, has, in recent decades, accelerated to the point where in some parts of the world, non-native plants now outnumber native ones. During any given 24-hour period, it is estimated that 10,000 different species are being moved around the world, just in ballast water. Thus, a single supertanker, or for that matter a jet passenger, can undo millions of years of geographic separation. Anthony Ricciardi, a specialist in introduced species at McGill University, has dubbed the current reshuffling of the Earth's biota a mass invasion event. It is, he has written, without precedent in the planet's history. As it happens, I live just east of Albany, relatively close to the cave where the first piles of dead bats were discovered. By the time I learned about what was going on, white nose syndrome, as it had become known, had spread as far as West Virginia and had killed something like a million bats. I called up Al Hicks, and he suggested, since it was once again bat census season, that I tag along for the next count. On a cold, gray morning, we met up in a parking lot not far from his office. From there, we headed almost due north, toward the Adirondacks. About 2 hours later, we arrived at the base of a mountain not far from Lake Champlain. In the 19th century and then again during World War II, the Adirondacks were a major source of iron ore, and shafts were sunk deep into the mountains. When the ore was gone, the shafts were abandoned by people and colonized by bats. For the census, we were going to enter a shaft of what was once the Barton Hill mine. The entrance was halfway up the mountainside, which was covered in several feet of snow. At the trailhead, more than a dozen people were standing around stomping their feet against the cold. Most, like Hicks, worked for New York State, but there were also a couple of biologists from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and a local novelist who was doing research for a book into which he was hoping to weave a white-nose subplot. Everyone put on snowshoes, except for the novelist, who, it seemed, had missed the message to bring a pair. The snow was icy and the going slow, so it took half an hour to get maybe half a mile. While we were waiting for the novelist to catch up, he was having trouble with the 3-foot-deep drifts. The conversation turned to the potential dangers of entering an abandoned mine. These, I was told, included getting crushed by falling rocks, being poisoned by a gas leak, and plunging over a sheer drop of 100 feet or more. After another half hour or so, we reached the mine entrance, essentially a large hole cut into the hillside. The stones in front of the entrance were white with bird droppings, and the snow was covered with paw prints. Evidently, ravens and coyotes had discovered that the spot was an easy place to pick up dinner. "Well, shit," Hicks said. Bats were fluttering in and out of the mine, and in some cases, crawling around on the snow. Hicks went to catch one. It was so lethargic that he grabbed it on the first try. He held it between his thumb and forefinger, snapped its neck, and placed it in a Ziploc bag. "Short survey today," he announced. We unstrapped our snowshoes, put on helmets and headlamps, and filed into the mine, down a long sloping tunnel. Shattered beams littered the ground, and bats flew up at us through the gloom. Hicks cautioned everyone to stay alert. "There's places that if you take a step, you won't be stepping back," he warned. The tunnel twisted along, sometimes opening up into concert hall-sized chambers with side tunnels leading out of them. Some of the chambers had acquired names. When we reached a sepulchral stretch known as the Don Thomas section, we split up into groups to start the survey. The process consisted of photographing as many bats as possible. Later on, back in Albany, somebody sitting at a computer screen would have to count all the bats in the pictures. I went with Hicks, who was carrying an enormous camera, and one of the biologists from the Fish and Wildlife Service, who had a laser pointer. Bats are highly social animals, and in the mine, they hung from the rock ceiling in crowded clusters. Most were little brown bats, Myotis lucifugus, or Lucys in bat-counting jargon. These are the dominant bat in the northeastern United States, and the sort most likely to be seen fluttering around on a summer night. As the name suggests, they're little, only about 5 inches long and 2/10 of an ounce in weight, and brown, with lighter colored fur on their bellies. The poet Randall Jarrell described them as being the color of coffee with cream in it. Hanging from the ceiling, with their wings folded, they looked like damp pom-poms. There were also small-footed bats, Myotis leibii, which can be identified by their very dark faces, and Indiana bats, Myotis sodalis, which, even before white nose, were listed as an endangered species. As we moved along, we kept disturbing the bats, which squeaked and rustled around, like half-asleep children. Despite the name, white nose is not confined to bats' noses. As we worked our way deeper into the mine, people kept finding bats with freckles of fungus on their wings and ears. Several of these were dispatched for study purposes with a thumb and forefinger. Each dead bat was sexed. Males can be identified by their tiny penises and placed in a Ziploc bag. Still today, it is not entirely understood how Geomyces destructans kills bats. What is known is that bats with white nose often wake up from their torpor and fly around in the middle of the day. It's been hypothesized that the fungus, which quite literally eats away at the bat's skin, irritates the animals to the point of arousal. This, in turn, causes them to use up the fat stores that were supposed to take them through the winter. On the edge of starvation, they fly out into the open to search for insects, which of course at that time of year are not available. It's also been proposed that the fungus causes the bats to lose moisture through their skin. This leads them to become dehydrated, which prompts them to wake up to go in search of water. Again, they use up critical energy stores and wind up emaciated and, finally, dead. We had entered the Barton Hill mine at around 1 p.m. By 7 p.m., we were almost back where we'd started, at the bottom of the mountain, except that now we were on the inside of it. We came to a huge, rusty winch, which, when the mine was operational, had been used to haul ore to the surface. Below it, the path disappeared into a pool of water, black like the river Styx. It was impossible to go farther, and so we began the long climb up. The movement of species around the world is sometimes compared to Russian roulette. As in the high-stakes game, two very different things can happen when a new organism shows up. The first, which might be called the empty chamber option, is nothing, either because the climate is unsuitable, or because the creature can't find enough to eat, or because it gets eaten itself, or for a host of other possible reasons, the new arrival doesn't survive, or at least fails to reproduce. Most potential introductions go unrecorded, indeed entirely unheeded, so it's hard to get precise figures. Almost certainly, though, the vast majority of potential invaders don't make it. In the second option, not only does the introduced organism survive, it gives rise to a new generation, which in turn survives and gives rise to another generation. This is what's known in the invasive species community as establishment. Again, it's impossible to say for sure how often this happens. Many established species probably remain confined to the spot where they were introduced, or they're so innocuous they've gone unnoticed. But, and here's where the roulette analogy comes back, a certain number complete the third step in the invasion process, which is spread. In 1916, a dozen strange beetles were discovered in a nursery near Riverton, New Jersey. By the following year, the insects, now known as Popillia japonica, or more commonly as Japanese beetles, had dispersed in all directions and could be found over an area of 3 square miles. The year after that, the figure jumped to 7 square miles, and the year after that, to 48 square miles. The beetle continued to expand its territory at a geometric rate, each year pushing out into a new concentric circle, and within 2 decades, it could be found from Connecticut to Maryland. it has since spread as far south as Alabama and as far west as Montana. Roy Van Dryce, an expert on invasive species at the University of Massachusetts, has estimated that out of every 100 potential introductions, somewhere between 5 and 15 will succeed in establishing themselves. Of these 5 to 15, one will turn out to be the bullet in the chamber. Why some introduced species are able to proliferate explosively is a matter of debate. One possibility is that for the species, as for grifters, there are advantages to remaining on the move. A species that's been transported to a new spot, especially on a new continent, has left many of its rivals and predators behind. This shaking free of foes, which is really the shaking free of evolutionary history, is referred to as enemy release. There are lots of organisms that appear to have benefited from enemy release, including purple loosestrife, which arrived in the northeastern United States from Europe in the early 19th century. In its native habitat, purple loosestrife has all sorts of specialized enemies, including the black-margined loosestrife beetle, the golden loosestrife beetle, the loosestrife root weevil, and the loosestrife flower weevil. All of these were absent in North America when the plant appeared, which helps explain why it's been able to take over boggy areas from West Virginia to Washington State. Some of these specialized predators have recently been introduced into the U.S. in an effort to control the plant's spread. This sort of it-takes-an-invasive-to-catch-an-invasive strategy has a decidedly mixed record. In some cases, it's proven highly successful. In others, it's turned out to be another ecological disaster. To the latter category belongs the rosy wolf snail, Euglandina rosea, which was introduced to Hawaii in the late 1950s. The wolf snail, a native of Central America, was brought in to prey on a previously introduced species, the giant African snail, Achatina fulica, which had become an agricultural pest. Euglandina rosea mostly left Achatina fulica alone and focused its attention instead on Hawaii's small, colorful native snails. Of the more than 700 species of endemic snails that once inhabited the islands, something like 90% are now extinct, and those that remain are in steep decline. The corollary to leaving old antagonists behind is finding new, naive organisms to take advantage of. A particularly famous and ghastly instance of this comes in the long, skinny form of the brown tree snake, Boiga irregularis. The snake is native to Papua New Guinea and northern Australia, and it found its way to Guam in the 1940s, probably in military cargo. The only snake indigenous to the island is a small, sightless creature the size of a worm. Thus, Guam's fauna was entirely unprepared for Boiga irregularis and its voracious feeding habits. The snake ate its way through most of the island's native birds, including the Guam flycatcher, last seen in 1984. The Guam rail, which survives only owing to a captive breeding program, and the Mariana fruit dove, which is extinct on Guam, though it persists on a couple of other smaller islands. Before the tree snake arrived, Guam had three native species of mammals, all bats. Today, only one, the Mariana's flying fox, remains, and it is considered highly endangered. Meanwhile, the snake, also a beneficiary of enemy release, was multiplying like crazy. At the peak of what is sometimes called its eruption, population densities were as high as 40 snakes per acre. So thorough has been the devastation wrought by the brown tree snake that it has practically run out of native animals to consume. Nowadays, it feeds mostly on other interlopers, like the curious skink, a lizard also introduced to Guam from Papua New Guinea. The author David Quammen cautions that while it is easy to demonize the brown tree snake, the animal is not evil, it's just amoral and in the wrong place. What Boiga irregularis has done in Guam, he observes, is precisely what Homo sapiens has done all over the planet. Succeeded extravagantly, at the expense of other species. With introduced pathogens, the situation is much the same. Long-term relationships between pathogens and their hosts are often characterized in military terms. The two are locked in an evolutionary arms race, in which to survive, each must prevent the other from getting too far ahead. When an entirely new pathogen shows up, it's like bringing a gun to a knife fight. Never having encountered the fungus, or virus, or bacterium before, the new host has no defenses against it. Such novel interactions, as they're called, can be spectacularly deadly. In the 1800s, the American chestnut was the dominant deciduous tree in eastern forests. In places like Connecticut, it made up close to half the standing timber. The tree, which can re-sprout from the roots, did fine even when heavily logged. Not only was the baby's crib likely made of chestnut, a plant pathologist named George Hepting once wrote, but chances were, so was the old man's coffin. Then, around the turn of the century, Cryptphenictria parasitica, the fungus responsible for chestnut blight, was imported to the U.S., probably from Japan. Asian chestnut trees, having co-evolved with Cryptphenictria parasitica, were easily able to withstand the fungus. But for the American species, it proved almost 100% lethal. By the 1950s, it had killed off practically every chestnut in the United States, some 4 billion trees. Several species of moths that depended on the tree disappeared along with it. Presumably, it's the novelty of the chytrid fungus that accounts for its deadliness as well. It explains why, all of a sudden, golden frogs disappeared from Thousand Frog Stream, and why amphibians in general are the planet's most threatened class of organism. Even before the cause of white nose syndrome was identified, Al Hicks and his colleagues suspected an introduced species. Whatever was killing the bats was presumably something they'd never encountered before, since the mortality rate was so high. Meanwhile, the syndrome was spreading from upstate New York in a classic bullseye pattern. This seemed to indicate that the killer had touched down near Albany. Suggestively, when the die-off began to make national news, a spelunker sent Hicks some photographs he'd shot about 40 miles west of the city. The photos dated from 2006, a full year before Hicks's co-workers had called him to say, "Holy shit," and they showed bats with clear signs of white nose. The spelunker had taken his pictures in a cave connected to Howe Caverns, a popular tourist destination which offers, among other attractions, flashlight tours and underground boat trips. It's kind of interesting that the first record we have of this is photographs from a commercial cave in New York that gets about 200,000 visits a year, Hicks told me. Introduced species are now so much a part of so many landscapes that chances are, if you glance out your window, you will see some. From where I'm sitting in western Massachusetts, I see grass, which someone at some point planted, and which most definitely is not native to New England. Almost all the grasses in American lawns come from somewhere else, including Kentucky bluegrass. Since my lawn is not particularly well kept, I also see lots of dandelions, which came over from Europe and spread just about everywhere, and garlic mustard, also from Europe, and broadleaf plantains, yet another invader from Europe. Plantains, Plantago major, seem to have arrived with the very first white settlers and were such a reliable sign of their presence that the Native Americans referred to them as white men's footsteps. If I get up from my desk and walk past the edge of the lawn, I can also find Multiflora rose, a prickly invasive from Asia, Queen Anne's lace, another introduction from Europe, burdock, similarly from Europe, and Oriental bittersweet, whose name speaks to its origins. According to a study of specimens in Massachusetts herbaria, nearly a third of all plant species documented in the state are naturalized newcomers. If I dig down a few inches, I'll encounter earthworms, which are also newcomers. Before Europeans arrived, New England had no earthworms of its own. The region's worms had all been wiped out by the last glaciation, and even after 10,000 years of relative warmth, North America's native worms had yet to recolonize the area. Earthworms eat through leaf litter, and in this way dramatically alter the makeup of forest soils. Although earthworms are beloved by gardeners, recent research has linked their introduction to a decline in native salamanders in the Northeast. As I write this, several new and potentially disastrous invaders appear to be in the process of spreading in Massachusetts. These include, in addition to Geomyces destructans, the Asian longhorned beetle, an import from China that feeds on a variety of hardwood trees, the emerald ash borer, also from Asia, whose larvae tunnel through and thereby kill ash trees, and the zebra mussel, a freshwater import from Eastern Europe that has the nasty habit of attaching itself to any available surface and consuming everything in the water column. "Stop aquatic hitchhikers," declares a sign by a lake down the road from where I live. "Clean all recreational equipment." The sign shows a picture of a boat entirely coated in zebra mussels, as if someone had mistakenly applied mollusks instead of paint. Wherever you are listening to this, the storyline is going to be roughly the same, and this goes not just for other parts of the United States, but all around the world. DAISY, a database of invasives in Europe, tracks more than 12,000 species. APASD, the Asian Pacific Alien Species Database, FISNA, the Forest Invasive Species Network for Africa, IBIS, the Island Biodiversity and Invasive Species Database, and NEMESIS, the National Exotic Marine and Estuarine Species Information System, track thousands more. In Australia, the problem is so severe that from preschool on, children are enlisted in the control effort. The city council in Townsville, north of Brisbane, urges kids to conduct regular hunts for cane toads, which were purposefully, albeit disastrously, introduced in the 1930s to control sugarcane beetles. Cane toads are poisonous, and trusting native species like the northern quoll eat them and die. To dispose of the toads humanely, the council instructs children to cool them in a fridge for 12 hours, and then place them in a freezer for another 12 hours. A recent study of visitors to Antarctica found that in a single summer season, tourists and researchers brought with them more than 70,000 seeds from other continents. Already one plant species, Poa annua, a grass from Europe, has established itself on Antarctica. Since Antarctica has only two native plant species, this means that a third of its plants are now invaders. From the standpoint of the world's biota, global travel represents a radically new phenomenon, and at the same time, a replay of the very old. The drifting apart of the continents that Wegener deduced from the fossil record is now being reversed. Another way in which humans are running geologic history backward and at high speed. Think of it as a souped-up version of plate tectonics, minus the plates. By transporting Asian species to North America, and North American species to Australia, and Australian species to Africa, and European species to Antarctica, we are, in effect, reassembling the world into one enormous supercontinent, what biologists sometimes refer to as the new Pangaea. Aeolus Cave, which is set into a wooded hillside in Dorset, Vermont, is believed to be the largest bat hibernaculum in New England. It is estimated that before White Nose hit, nearly 300,000 bats, some from as far away as Ontario and Rhode Island, came there to spend the winter. A few weeks after I went with Hicks to the Barton Hill mine, he invited me to accompany him to Aeolus. This trip had been organized by the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department, and at the bottom of the hill, instead of strapping on snowshoes, we all piled onto snowmobiles. The trail zigged up the mountain in a series of long switchbacks. The temperature, about 25 degrees, was far too low for bats to be active, but when we parked near the entrance to the cave, I could see bats fluttering around. The most senior of the Vermont officials, Scott Darling, announced that before going any farther, we'd all have to put on latex gloves and Tyvek suits. This seemed to me to be paranoid, a gesture out of the novelist's White Nose subplot. Soon, however, I came to see the sense of it. Aeolus was created by water flow over the course of thousands and thousands of years. To keep people out, the Nature Conservancy, which owns the cave, has blocked off the entrance with huge iron slats. With a key, one of the horizontal slats can be removed. This creates a narrow gap that can be crawled or slithered through. Despite the cold, a sickening smell emanated from the opening, half game farm, half garbage dump. The stone path leading to the gate was icy and difficult to get a footing on. When it was my turn, I squeezed between the slats and immediately slid into something soft and dank. This, I realized, picking myself back up, was a pile of dead bats. The entrance chamber of the cave, known as Guano Hall, is maybe 30 feet wide and 20 feet high at the front. Toward the back, it narrows and slopes. The tunnels that branch off from there are accessible only to spelunkers, and the tunnels that branch off from those are accessible only to bats. Peering into Guano Hall, I had the sense that I was staring into a giant gullet. The scene in the dimness was horrific. There were long icicles hanging from the ceiling, and from the floor, large knobs of ice rose up, like polyps. The ground was covered with dead bats. Some of the ice knobs, I noticed, had bats frozen into them. There were torpid bats roosting on the ceiling, and also wide-awake ones, which would take off and fly by, or, sometimes, right into us. Why bat corpses pile up in some places, while in others they get eaten or in some other way disappear, is unclear. Hicks speculated that the conditions at Aeolus were so harsh that the bats didn't even make it out of the cave before dropping dead. He and Darling had planned to do a count of the bats in Guano Hall, but this plan was quickly abandoned in favor of just collecting specimens. Darling explained that the specimens would be going to the American Museum of Natural History, so that there would at least be a record of the hundreds of thousands of Lucys and northern long-eared and tricolored bats that had once wintered in Aeolus. This may be one of the last opportunities, he said. In contrast to a mine, which has been around for at most a few centuries, Aeolus, he pointed out, has existed for millennia. It's likely that bats have been hibernating there, generation after generation, since the cave's entrance was exposed at the end of the last ice age. That's what makes this so dramatic. It's breaking the evolutionary chain, Darling said. He and Hicks began picking dead bats off the ground. Those that were too badly decomposed were tossed back. Those that were more or less intact were sexed and placed in 2-quart plastic bags. I helped out by holding the bag for dead females. Soon it was full, and another one was started. When the specimen count hit somewhere around 500, Darling decided that it was time to go. Hicks hung back. He'd brought along his enormous camera and said that he wanted to take more pictures. In the hours we had been slipping around in the cave, the carnage had grown even more grotesque. Many of the bat carcasses had been crushed, and now there was blood oozing out of them. As I made my way up toward the entrance, Hicks called after me, "Don't step on any dead bats." It took me a moment to realize he was joking. When exactly the new Pangaea project began is difficult to say. If you count people as an invasive species, the science writer Alan Burdick has called Homo sapiens arguably the most successful invader in biological history, the process goes back 120,000 years or so, to the period when modern humans first migrated out of Africa. By the time humans pushed into North America, around 13,000 years ago, they had domesticated dogs, which they brought with them across the Bering land bridge. The Polynesians who settled Hawaii around 1,500 years ago were accompanied not only by rats, but also by lice, fleas, and pigs. The discovery of the New World initiated a vast biological swap meet, the so-called Columbian Exchange, which took the process to a whole new level. Even as Darwin was elaborating the principles of geographic distribution, those principles were being deliberately undermined by groups known as acclimatization societies. The very year On the Origin of Species was published, a member of an acclimatization society based in Melbourne released the first rabbits into Australia. They've been breeding there like, well, rabbits, ever since. In 1890, a New York group that took as its mission the introduction and acclimatization of such foreign varieties of the animal and vegetable kingdom as might prove useful or interesting imported European starlings to the U.S. The head of the group supposedly wanted to bring to America all the birds mentioned in Shakespeare. 100 starlings let loose in Central Park have by now multiplied to more than 200 million. Still today, Americans often deliberately import foreign varieties they think might prove useful or interesting. Garden catalogs are filled with non-native plants, and aquarium catalogs with non-native fish. According to the entry on pets in the Encyclopedia of Biological Invasions, every year more non-indigenous species of mammals, birds, amphibians, turtles, lizards, and snakes are brought into the U.S. than the country has native species of these groups. Meanwhile, as the pace and volume of global trade have picked up, so too has the number of accidental imports. Species that couldn't survive an ocean crossing at the bottom of a canoe or in the hold of a whaling ship may easily withstand the same journey in the ballast tank of a modern cargo vessel, or the bay of an airplane, or in a tourist's suitcase. A recent study of non-indigenous species in North American coastal waters found that the rate of reported invasions has increased exponentially over the past 200 years. It attributed the accelerating pace to the increased quantities of goods being transported, and also to the increased speed with which they travel. The Center for Invasive Species Research, which is based at the University of California, Riverside, estimates that California is now acquiring a new invasive species every 60 days. This is slow compared to Hawaii, where a new invader is added each month. For comparison's sake, it's worth noting that before humans settled Hawaii, new species seem to have succeeded in establishing themselves on the archipelago roughly once every 10,000 years. The immediate effect of all this reshuffling is a rise in what might be called local diversity. Pick any place on Earth, Australia, the Antarctic Peninsula, your local park, and more likely than not, over the last few hundred years, the number of species that can be found in the area has grown. Before humans arrived on the scene, many whole categories of organisms were missing from Hawaii. These included not only rodents, but also amphibians, terrestrial reptiles, and ungulates. The island had no ants, aphids, or mosquitoes. People have, in this sense, enriched Hawaii greatly. But Hawaii was, in its pre-human days, home to thousands of species that existed nowhere else on the planet, and many of these endemics are now gone or disappearing. The losses include, in addition to the several hundred species of land snails, dozens of species of birds, and more than 100 species of ferns and flowering plants. For the same reasons that local diversity has, as a general rule, been increasing, global diversity, the total number of different species that can be found worldwide, has dropped. The study of invasives is often said to have begun with Charles Elton, a British biologist who published his seminal work, The Ecology of Invasions by Animals and Plants, in 1958. To explain the apparently paradoxical effects of moving species around, Elton used the analogy of a set of glass tanks. Imagine that each of the tanks is filled with a different solution of chemicals. Then imagine every tank connected to its neighbors by long, narrow tubes. If the taps to the tubes were left open for just a minute each day, the solutions would slowly start to diffuse. The chemicals would recombine. Some new compounds would form, and some of the original compounds would drop out. It might take quite a long time before the whole system came into equilibrium, Elton wrote. Eventually, though, all of the tanks would hold the same solution. The variety would have been eliminated, which was just what could be expected to happen by bringing long isolated plants and animals into contact. If we look far enough ahead, the eventual state of the biological world will become not more complex, but simpler and poorer, Elton wrote. Since Elton's day, ecologists have tried to quantify the effects of total global homogenization by means of a thought experiment. The experiment starts with the compression of all the world's land masses into a single megacontinent. The species-area relationship is then used to estimate how much variety such a landmass would support. The difference between this figure and the diversity of the world as it actually is represents the loss implied by complete interconnectedness. In the case of terrestrial mammals, the difference is 66%, which is to say that a single continent world would be expected to contain only about a third as many mammalian species as currently exist. For land birds, it's just under 50%, meaning such a world would contain half as many bird species as the present one. If we look even farther ahead than Elton did, millions of years farther, the biological world will, in all likelihood, become more complex again. Assuming that eventually travel and global commerce cease, the new Pangaea will, figuratively speaking, begin to break up. The continents will again separate, and islands will be re-isolated. And as this happens, new species will evolve and radiate from the invasives that have been dispersed around the world. Hawaii, perhaps, will get giant rats, and Australia, giant bunnies. The winter after I visited Aeolus with Al Hicks and Scott Darling, I went back with another group of wildlife biologists. The scene in the cave was very different this time around, but no less macabre. Over the course of the year, the piles of bloody dead bats had almost completely decomposed, and all that was left was a carpet of delicate bones, each no thicker than a pine needle. Ryan Smith, of the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department, and Susie Van Ottingen, of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, were running the census this time around. They started with a cluster of bats hanging at the widest part of Guano Hall. On closer inspection, Smith noticed that most animals in the cluster were already dead, their tiny feet hooked to the rock in rigor mortis. But he thought he saw some living bats among the corpses. He called out the number to Van Ottingen, who'd brought along a pencil and some index cards. "Two Lucys," Smith said. "Two Lucys," Van Ottingen repeated, writing the number down. Smith worked his way deeper into the cave. Van Ottingen called me over and gestured toward a crack in the rock face. Apparently, at one point, there had been dozens of bats hibernating inside it. Now there was just a layer of black muck, studded with toothpick-sized bones. She recalled having seen, on an earlier visit to the cave, A live bat trying to nuzzle a group of dead ones. It just broke my heart, she said. Bat sociability has turned out to be a great boon to Geomyces destructans.